As you know, this is the second part of a two-part lecture on the Peace of 1919. Okay? And so let me begin today by just reviewing where we left off last time and what the lecture last time was about, what we're trying to do at this point in the course. We have this very fundamental issue. It's one of the central issues that defines the entire field of international relations. This is the normative issue, the prescriptive issue, the issue of what makes for good foreign policy. Is there anything you could say of a general nature that could serve as guidance in the elaboration of policy? And the central issue here, the issue that dominates this debate, both among scholars and also to a certain extent among practitioners, is this question of realism versus liberalism. You have this liberal philosophy of international politics, a set of ideas about how foreign policy should be conducted. This is the basic concept that people absorb just growing up in a society like the United States. Foreign policy should embody the basic values of the society. If we believe in democracy, our foreign policy should aim to promote democracy abroad. If we believe in human rights, we should stand up for human rights. If we believe in the rule of law, we should stand up for the rule of law in international politics. Politics should be based on moral principle, right? It should not be based on balance of power considerations, those sorts of things, policies, you know, that are based on political interests defined in power political terms, what improves a country's position in the international power system. This is viewed as something to be shunned, something to be avoided, something that leads to problems. Right? Why did you have the First World War? Well, there was this whole notion that came to being. You had the First World War because of the nature of the political system that was in place at the time, before 1914. The old system of arms and alliances, the balance of power philosophy, the search for unilateral strategic advantage. This is what pushed states into conflict with each other. These conflicts, this competition for security, a scarce good, the more one got, the less the other side would have, and so on. This caused all these arms races and all of these problems that ultimately culminated in the war. The old diplomacy that didn't pay any attention to moral principle, morally blind, naturally this would lead to war. Okay, so you have all of those notions. And then the countervailing tradition, which came into being in reaction to that, is this whole notion of realism. No, that way of looking at things screws things up. That whole liberal philosophy, that's not the solution, that's the problem. That's why you have all these problems in international politics. Countries should set their sights lower. They shouldn't think of the international arena in moral terms. They should realize that there are no moral absolutes here. Every country has its own interests. If you want a stable system, you have to concern yourself with power realities, making sure that countries are willing to live with things as they are, that they have an incentive in power political terms to live with things as they are, not to kind of rise up against the status quo. If you look for that sort of stability, that's the most you can do. And if you try for more the way, you know, the liberals say, you're going to end up with real problems. And you see that philosophy embodied in all sorts of fundamental realist texts, like that thing by George Kennan that you read. The Kennan article about American intervention in the First World War. A realist critique of the Wilsonian philosophy. The argument that it was is Wilsonianism that created all these problems. It wasn't the solution. It was the source of all these problems. You gotta think in power terms. You can't think in moral terms, right? That's the real issue, right? Given the importance of those issues, you naturally have to ask yourself, how do you get a handle on it? How do you go about figuring out how to make up your own mind about what the answers are? Right? Just by, you know, accepting what other people say, or I mean, in this class, are you simply expected to kind of take what I say on faith? No, if that's the way you feel, I would feel like I'm a total failure as a teacher. You gotta figure out how to make up your mind for yourself. And the key thing to note here is that there's a method for doing so. Well, what's the method? The first point to notice is that there's a certain affinity between these general theoretical arguments and particular historical interpretations. In a sense, these general theories kind of translate into sets of expectations about what you would find in different historical contexts, sets of historical interpretations about how these particular episodes are to be understood. If you're a liberal, you take this view that if the Treaty of 1919, the Versailles Treaty, failed, well, that wasn't Wilson's fault. It couldn't fail because of the fundamental nature of the program that Wilson adopted, because this program is essentially the right way to go about doing things, to think in moral terms. Yeah? It must have failed because the Wilson program was frustrated, you know, by these Europeans, especially the French, who, although they might have been a democracy in domestic political terms, they still thought in these kind of old-fashioned power political terms, imperialist terms. They were unwilling to kind of rise to the level of understanding that Wilson represented. Right? So the Wilsonian view, the liberal view, translates into a certain interpretation of the Paris Peace Conference, Treaty of Versailles, the failure of the peace of 1919, the origins of the Second World War. Right? It's like, it's not because of the Wilson program, it's because Wilson was defeated that a different way of looking at things came to dominate the peacemaking process. And different conceptions, non-Wilsonian conceptions, more old-fashioned power political notions, these were responsible for the shaping of the Versailles Peace. That's why it failed, right? That's the liberal view. And sure enough, you know, defenders of Wilson, defenders of Wilsonianism, liberalism in international politics, took that line for many years. That was like the standard view of peacemaking 1919. What happened after the First World War? This is a vindictive peace, not a Wilsonian peace. It represented Wilson's defeat, not the triumph of the Wilsonian view. Right? Very common view. And it's a natural view for people who share that political perspective to hold. On the other hand, there's the realist view. You see kind of elements of it in that Kennan piece that, oh no, that's not what happened in 1919. Wilsonianism wasn't the solution, it was the problem. This is what led to such an unstable peace. You know, the inability to think in power political terms, these moralistic conceptions that we know we're right, we know the other side is wrong. You don't want to use power. Power is not a normal or natural element of international political life. You know, there's something wrong with using power for purely political purposes. Power, political purposes above all. Power should be held in reserve when the moral issues are clear-cut. So before they're clear-cut, you don't do anything. You sit on your hands. As soon as they're clear-cut, you enter into the fray, and the war becomes a kind of crusade. You want to absolutely destroy your adversary. This kind of all-or-nothing character to that sort of policy, that's profoundly destabilizing because it's this rupture, it's this discontinuity. And discontinuities of that sort are always destabilizing because the other powers in the system find it very hard to adjust. So one day you don't care at all. The next day you're just in 100%. You want to absolutely slaughter the dragon. The dragon is slaughtered. Then you withdraw. You know, you wash your hands of the whole thing. That's not a recipe for stability. All right. That's the realist view. General interpretations translate into historical interpretations of what happened in the post-World War I. So, and what this means is, therefore, that to get at the fundamental conceptual issue, you want to focus on those specific historical questions, right? Who's right? Which interpretation is valid, right? The history is, I personally think the history is very interesting in its own terms, but it's also very interesting because it has all these theoretical resonances, conceptual resonances that you should be attentive to, because that's the only real way to get a handle on these conceptual issues, studying the historical problem closely. Well, how do you go about studying it? Just plunge in, just start reading things in a kind of mindless way? No, you have to be very active. You take the problem apart, you know, step by step, making it more and more concrete, because the more concrete an issue is, the more studyable it is. The more concrete a question is, the more answerable it is on the basis of the evidence. Right? That's what analysis means. The word analysis means taking things apart. And so that's what we've been doing last lecture and this lecture, taking the stuff apart. What are the general policies pursued by the victor powers in the post-World War I period, 1918-1919, immediate post-war period, right? What's Wilson's policy? What's the British policy? The policy of David Lloyd George, British Prime Minister. Policy of French, Georges Clemenceau, French Prime Minister. Look at these policies first at the general level, and that's what we did last time. What's the point here? Was Wilson the great champion of a peace of reconciliation, the way some people claim? No, he was the champion of a punitive peace. Was this simply because of these wartime passions? No, it's deeply rooted in the basic philosophy. You believe in moral principles. You believe in justice. Well, justice means punishing the criminal nation. If war is viewed as a crime and not as a normal product of international political life, then the criminal has to be punished. That's what justice means. It's backward looking. You're not looking to the future, to how to construct a stable international system. You're looking to the past, punishing the lawbreaker. You believe in the rule of law? That whole notion would be a travesty, a sham, if the lawbreaker was allowed to get off scot-free. The lawbreaker had to recognize his crimes, and by that I mean the whole German nation, you know, make penance for those crimes, atone for those crimes, and then after maybe 20 years or so, a generation of thoughtfulness, we'll use that term, then you would allow them back into the community of civilized nations. But first they had to show that their true remorse and to make a real effort to make amends for what they had done. Basic Wilson philosophy. Whereas the French especially tended to take a much more jaded view. You know, you can't base policy on those moral principles. You had to concern yourself with power considerations. Did this mean necessarily the French were going to pursue a harsh policy? Well, a certain element of that was conceivable and consistent with that basic orientation. But the fundamental emphasis of French policy was on preserving the wartime coalition, the coalition of the three Western powers. If they stayed together, you didn't really have to worry too much about Germany because as a bloc, they were much stronger than Germany. So as Clemenceau says, to preserve this Entente, I will make any sacrifice. That's the French policy, meaning that Wilson's essentially in the driver's seat. He can lay down his terms. He may say, well, that's the general policy, but you could point to all these kind of punitive utterances of Wilson, and I read you a bunch of these things last time. He say, but what meaning does it have? A lot of this stuff is just kind of rhetoric that people throw out. The real test of policy, it's what's done on specifics, right? So after the analysis at the general level, U.S., British, French policy, the general level, the philosophy of peacemaking at the general level, then you shift focus and look at policy on specific issues, right? So that's the first level of analysis, general versus specific. The specific policies, again, we're going to look at systematically. First, the territorial issues, then the non-territorial issues, okay? With the territorial issues, we're going to first look at the issues relating to Germany's western border, and then the issues relating to Germany's eastern border. And then those issues we'll deal with one by one. With regard to Germany's eastern border, there are issues relating to Poland, Czechoslovakia, Austria. We're going to look first at Poland. Poland, there's the whole issue of what was called the Polish Corridor, which is this area here on the map ceded by Germany to the new Polish state that's resurrected. Poland, as you know, hadn't existed since the 18th century as an independent state. Now it's resurrected as an independent state. One of Wilson's principles was the resurrection of Poland with access to the sea. And so the Polish corridor was to be given, what was called the Polish corridor, separating the main part of Germany here from this part here called East Prussia. This area here within these kind of pink lines, this is called the Polish corridor because it was a corridor to the sea. That was to be given to Poland. Then there was a whole other area here in Germany's southeast called Upper Silesia. Very important because this is a coal-producing and therefore a steel-producing area. Again, there was the whole question of would Poland be allowed to have Upper Silesia or not? All right, so we'll look at all of these specific issues. We're breaking it down step by step so that we can examine this stuff systematically. The non-territorial issues, disarmament, war crimes, war guilt, reparations, all these kinds of things, we'll look at League of Nations, look at one by one. And as we look at these things systematically, we're going to apply systematically these two tests, two questions. You always got to apply questions when you're doing this sort of analysis because these questions, they draw out what's important in the historical evidence. They're like a chemical stain that you spread on a biological specimen that throws into relief what you're interested in. And in this case, we have these two questions. First is this view that one finds in the traditional historical literature that the Paris Peace Conference, the process that led to the negotiation of the Treaty of Versailles between Germany and the Western powers, the basic peace treaty that settled World War I, were these negotiations to be understood essentially as a contest between the Americans, led by Woodrow Wilson, champions of a relatively moderate peace, a peace of reconciliation with Germany, and the Europeans, especially the French, who refused to accept that Wilsonian philosophy and took a much harder line. Right? That's a view that you find in a lot of historical textbooks, even to this day, right? Is that view, in fact, correct? A struggle between America and France. That's number one. Number two is when you look at the final arrangements that were worked out, the arrangements that were embodied in the text of the treaty, are those arrangements in line with Wilson's basic political philosophy, with the basic Wilsonian program as was laid out and elaborated during the war and in the immediate post-war period. Okay, so we're going to apply those tests. All right, so let me begin now with the territorial issues, starting with the West. What do you find here? Well, you find, this is the area that's most aligned with the traditional interpretation. You find the French, not wanting to actually annex these areas that lay to the west of the Rhine River. Oh, it was called the left bank of the Rhine. This blue line here is the Rhine River. But rather, mainly toward creating states not subject to the authority of the Berlin government, of the German government, but rather kind of under the military protection of the Allies and under the effective control when it comes to foreign policy of the Western powers, and especially the French themselves. Okay. And yes, this program was resisted by both the Americans and the British. The British Prime Minister said that he did not want to create a new Alsace-Lorraine to poison the peace of Europe by taking what were indisputably German territories and cutting them off from the German state. And so they reached a compromise. Right? The Rhineland was to be occupied, not just by the French, but by the Western powers in general. The occupation would last for 15 years, as long as Germany complied with the treaty. The left bank of the Rhine plus three bridgeheads on the right bank of the Rhine. And if Germany complied with the treaty, then the Rhineland was to be evacuated in five-year intervals. The northern zone after the first 5 years, the central zone after the second 5 years, and the third zone in its entirety after the third 5 years. In other words, by 1935 or so, the entire Rhineland would be evacuated, you know, subject to the proviso that the Germans complied with the treaty. So the French were getting something. Why did they want the Rhineland? Because the Rhine River is this very broad river, hard to kind of cross it. And so if you entrench yourself on the left bank of the Rhine, you could defend yourself against the German invasion if Germany recovered her power. So the French were already thinking defensive terms here. What are we going to do once Germany becomes strong again? Okay. Not just that, but the French were given something else besides. They were given these treaties of guarantee. Both the British and the Americans promised that they would come to the aid of France in the event of German aggression in the future. The British guarantee would only come into effect if the American did, and the American guarantee kind of went down the tubes when the U.S. Senate refused to ratify the Treaty of Versailles that was linked to these treaties. That fact that France had basically made compromises on the basis of these assurances, which were now being taken away, that didn't change anything. The treaty text remained intact. Okay, but that whole story shows you, well, there's something in that traditional view. You know, the French did pursue a policy of somewhat kind of disguised annexation. That's what they wanted. The Americans and the British kind of resisted that. But the final arrangement was kind of in line with the basic Wilsonian program, this 15-year period of occupation. Well, this went hand-in-hand with the notion that the Germans had caused the war, the Germans had to pay a price for that, they should be held accountable, that there should be a 20-year or so period in which Germany didn't have the same political rights as everyone else, because there had to be this kind of generation of thoughtfulness, Wilson's term. All right? What about Germany's eastern border? Here the story is more complex. The end of the First World War was accompanied by the breakup of the Habsburg monarchy. And Wilson's 14 points, he didn't actually call for the breakup of the Habsburg monarchy on the basis of national self-determination. This is this huge multinational empire, you know, Czechs and Poles in the north, you know, Southern Slavs in the south, Hungarians, the German-speaking people in what's today the Austrian state. There were Romanians in Transylvania. There were, you know, Ruthenians who were kind of sort of Ukrainians in the in the Northeast. I mean, this is a polyglot empire if there ever was one. And Wilson didn't want to necessarily break it up. He simply called for autonomy for certain of these nationalities, Czechs, Slovaks, and so on. But these nationalities, as the Central Powers were losing and the Austrian monarchy was kind of disintegrating, took matters into their own hands and they proclaimed independence. Right? So they went kind of a little bit beyond the Wilson program. And what this meant was that the German-speaking areas, contemporary Austria, remained as a kind of rump state, and it wasn't terribly viable economically because basically you had this huge metropolis, Vienna, surrounded by a relatively small hinterland in German Austria. It was a metropolis for a huge empire. And people wondered about whether it would be economically viable as these new states began to, you know, take matters in their own hand and favor their own industries and build tariff barriers and so on. So a lot of people in this rump state of German Austria, they wanted to merge themselves into the new German Republic. It's called the Weimar Republic. But the Allies weren't here for this, right? They didn't think that it was a violation of the Austrian Germans' right of self-determination to insist that they remain independent. Because if their 10 million or so population was added to the, 60, 70 million people in Germany itself, then German predominance over France, which just had 40 million people, would become kind of overwhelming. And so Austria was prevented from becoming part of Germany, right? Violation of Wilson principle. Wilson didn't have any real problems with this. Certainly the French didn't, nor did the British. Same sort of point applies to the new state of Czechoslovakia, which was carved out of the Habsburg monarchy. The fringe area of Czechoslovakia that adjoins Germany, you can see that from the ethnographic map over here. This fringe area is not inhabited by Czechs and Slovaks. By Slavs. It's inhabited by Germans, German-speaking people. These people had been part of the Austrian Empire before the war. They're called the Sudeten Germans because this is a mountainous area called the Sudeten Sudetenland, the Sudeten Mountains. It was felt like, well, they also could be prevented from becoming part of Germany because the new Czech state needed defensible borders, and these mountainous borders are more defensible than Czech borders would be without these areas. So once again, since it's a violation of this core Wilsonian principle of absolute national self-determination, but these areas hadn't been Germany before the war. Strategic considerations, had a certain legitimacy in this context. Wilson did not have any serious problem with this. The Polish issue, however, was much more important. Poland was to be resurrected, as I said before, one of the 14 points, one of Wilson's principles, with access to the sea. And this meant that, given that this is an area of kind of mixed population, that a lot of German-speaking people were going to be put under Polish control. Okay? And a lot of these people were ethnically Polish, in terms of Polish ancestry, Polish names, but they had assimilated into the German culture in pretty much the same way that the Alsatians, who to this day at home speak a dialect of German, had come to think of themselves as French. Right? So what are you going to do? Defer to their subjective sense of themselves as German citizens? Or are you going to say, well, they only came to think of themselves as Germans because the Germans were so strong that they had all these years to kind of brainwash them and educate them so that they would think of themselves as Germans. So the Poles should have a right to take people who were, in biological terms, more closely related to them and brainwash them back into being Polish. And this is particularly true since the Poles needed these areas in order to have secure access to the sea. You see the Vistula River there that runs through Warsaw. This is like the central artery of Poland. It goes out to the sea at Danzig. And for economic reasons, it was felt like Poland needed this access to the sea. So all these things were taken into account, and in the treaty, this area there, it's called the Polish Corridor, was ceded by Germany to Poland, even though it had a lot of people in it who thought of themselves as Germans. Similarly, this Upper Silesia, this coal mining area and a metallurgical industry had grown up above the coal fields, considered very important to Poland. A lot of these miners were of Polish origin, but they thought of themselves as German. What do you find here when you look at the diplomacy of these issues? You find the Americans taking a relatively soft, moderate, pro-German line with the French on the other side, the British halfway in between. No. It's like you find the Americans sympathizing with the Poles and siding with the Poles on all these issues. And the Americans and the French together took a pro-Polish view. It was the British who didn't like the Poles, thought the Poles would misrule the Germans who had been put under their control, that this would lead also to all sorts of resentment on the part of the Germans. The British were the ones who wanted a softer arrangement, and these compromises that were worked out at the end were an attempt to kind of meet these British objections at least halfway. So that there was to be a plebiscite held in 1921 that would govern the fate of Upper Silesia. On the basis of that plebiscite, the League of Nations would decide the fate of Upper Silesia. Right? With regard to the corridor, there is a city at the mouth of the Vistula River called Danzig. Today it's called Gdansk. That was inhabited like 99% by German people. Instead of giving this to Poland, it was made a free city and put under the authority of the League of Nations. All right, so these are kind of compromises. Not a violation of Wilson's principles by any means. It was very much in line with what American policy had been. Self-determination for the Poles. You know, you want to stand up for the rights of this long oppressed nationality and so on. Okay. The non-territorial issues, and there are a whole bunch of them. We could begin with the issues that had the greatest moral weight. These were the provisions regarding the war criminals, the Germans who had been considered guilty of causing the war, like the Kaiser, or for committing atrocities in the course of the war. Submarine commanders, for example, or German occupation forces dealing with resistance in occupied areas like Belgium. These people were supposed to be brought to trial. Right? Yeah, the German argument, like, well, these things happened in war. The Allies did all kinds of awful things, too. They tried to starve the German nation and so on. Well, let's have an impartial body if you're serious about the rule of law. Oh, nothing doing. So this meant, this is just victor's justice. This is not. They pretend to be rule of law, but it's actually just vengeance, right? Who really is pushing all these provisions about the war criminals? The vindictive French? No, they don't really care about this stuff because they take a more jaded view of what happens in a war. It's the British who really get up on their high horse about these things. Wilson resists a little bit, but the Americans are told by the British, if you believe in the rule of law, and you're always talking about the law, rule of law, you have to bring the lawbreakers to trial. I mean, it's of vital importance that we at least establish that principle of accountability. And Wilson is won over by those arguments. And then there's something, you can see how the Germans would resent all this stuff. You're criminals. You're guilty. You're to blame for the war. Right. As far as the Allies were concerned, it was obvious Germany was to blame for the war. no problem about including these provisions in the treaty. So that, for example, the famous Article 231 of the Treaty of Versailles, the so-called War Guilt Clause, which held Germany responsible for the war, which was put in the treaty in order to provide a legal basis for demanding reparations from Germany. No one objected to this. Wilson had no problem with a provision in the treaty that assigned responsibility to Germany for having caused the war. Right. Again, very much in line with his fundamental philosophy. Next, the disarmament provisions. Very important because, you know, like I told you last time, the essence of the Versailles system, the system embodied in the Treaty of Versailles, was that if Germany were allowed to regain her normal power status, to build up her power to whatever level she was physically, economically capable of, German power would overwhelm France if the Anglo-Saxons withdrew from the continent. And so what you needed were these artificial constraints on German power that would keep Germany down, right? Keep Germany from being able to pursue a policy that looked toward the overturning of the European status quo and toward regaining or actually achieving a position of hegemony in Europe that would be greater still than what the Germans had in 1914. Right? And so you needed artificial constraints on German power. And the disarmament provisions were the heart of the system. They, and you know, with regard to the Rhineland also, the Rhineland was supposed to be demilitarized and not fortified and so on. But Germany was not to build major armed forces. Germany was not to have an air force. Germany was not to have a navy to speak of. The German army was to have only 100,000 men in it. The French wanted to allow the Germans 200,000. The British said 100,000 because the French wanted it to be based on the draft, on conscription, because they had this theory of the nation in arms, and conscription is much more democratic than a professional army. The British had a tradition of professional army. The British got their way on all of these things. No objection on the part of America. Right. You can see that the French are by no means the most vindictive in this whole area. League of Nations. This is a very important part of the Wilson program. If you're going to substitute, if you're going to get rid of the balance of power, how are you going to deal with people's security problems? Well, instead of a balance of power, we'll have a community of power, a pooling of power, through this League of Nations mechanism. And Article 10 of the League of Nations, which is the proof of League of Nations covenant, and the covenant of the League was an integral part of the peace treaties, including the Versailles Peace Treaty. Article 10 of the League said that all the members of the League would undertake to guarantee the existing territorial status quo. You know, it's like the British wanted to soften that. They didn't want these kind of hard and fast commitments. They wanted a degree of flexibility. Wilson fought that. He got his way. He said if the British had their way, then the League of Nations would become nothing more than an influential debating society. On the other hand, the French took this notion of the League very seriously because they thought the League could be an instrument for keeping Germany down, for mobilizing the resources of the whole world in defense of the status quo. And they wanted the League to have its own army. And Wilson rejected that as well. He said that would be to substitute for national militarism, international militarism. This dislikes the whole notion that military power should be a normal, natural, integral part of international political life, right? And Wilson gets his way with the League, naturally, in terms of the drafting of the treaty. And, of course, it's voted down by the U.S. Senate. And finally, the reparations. Very important, as we're going to see, in the post-1919 period. This becomes the issue that lies at the heart of international political life. The central issue. what was going on with the reparations? Again, is this a struggle between Wilson, champion of a moderate peace, and the Europeans, especially the French, who wanted a vindictive settlement? Well, that's the account you see in all of these textbooks. I did my thesis on this stuff, so it was all very clear in my mind. It turned out, I mean, kind of to my amazement, that whole story about the reparations is just totally false. Right? The French were not interested in a vindictive, impossible reparation settlement. They wanted a workable reparation settlement. They weren't even looking for huge reparations from the Germans. They and the Americans pretty much agreed on the figure to be demanded of the Germans, $30 billion, you know. $30 billion today, that's like pocket change for most of these governments. In those days, it was a substantial sum, but the repayment of a $30 billion debt over, say, a 30-year period would be something like 5 or 6% of national income. And for a country that didn't even have to maintain an army like Germany, this was by no means an impossible sum. But they couldn't reach an agreement at the Paris Peace Conference. On the basis of that figure that the French and the Americans agreed to. Why couldn't they agree to it? Because the British wouldn't go along with it. And why wouldn't the British go along with it? Because they demanded, for domestic political reasons most notably, a much more extreme reparation debt. They were going to double it, pretty much, by including reparations pensions and separation allowances. It's pretty much double the debt. And when the British called for this sort of thing, his own advisors, especially the young John Foster Dulles, future Eisenhower Secretary of State, we'll be hearing about him in the future, but as a young man, he was an expert in the American delegation at the peace conference. Dulles and these other American experts said to Wilson, you can't go along with this British demand. It's a violation of the pre-armistice agreement. You know, the Germans basically promised that they would, make compensation for the material damages that they had caused. And now they want to include all these things like pensions and separation allowances. He's like, if you do that, it weakens our moral position because if you're saying the Germans are responsible for all the costs of the war, then what you'd be saddling them with would just be just so utterly beyond their capacity to pay. The same logic that ruled out war costs should also rule out reparations. So Wilson is meeting with his reparation advisors, turns around to them when they make this argument, and he says, logic. I don't give a damn about logic. I'm going to include the pensions, because he was persuaded by this British argument. It's an emotional argument. Say, how could you say that Germany should be responsible for making amends for the material devastation, for compensating for damage to property? Whereas damage to human life, they're not going to be held responsible for. That means you consider property to be more important than human life. And Wilson was persuaded by this argument. So he sides with the British against the French. Right? And I should say that another kind of interesting thing about the reparation negotiations is that, I'll just tell you a couple of things. Why did the French not want huge reparations? Because they're, yes? I'm sorry? I can't hear you. I do that. Those are, just the rhetorical questions. Why did the French not want huge reparations? The answer was that their whole plan for the economic recovery of France, for reconstruction of the devastated areas in the north of France, where the major part of the war had been fought, you know, was the continuation of these arrangements for inter-allied economic cooperation that had come into being, especially in the last year of the war. They wanted to draw on American resources. It's Wilson that doesn't want any part of that. There's no Marshall Plan after World War I the way there was after World War II. When the French start making it clear they want to draw on American resources, Wilson's whole reaction is, we didn't cause the war. Why should we have to pay for it, right? Again, you can see how this moralistic view can be destabilizing. Okay, and so when the French begin to realize that neither the Americans nor the British are really going to help them out, what do? They try and bludgeon them into changing their view by saying, if you don't help us out, we're going to really have to come hard on the Germans. But when they realize that tactic doesn't work, they give up on that after a relatively moderate set of arrangements, and in fact enter into talks with the Germans, talks which have this kind of proto-Gaullist, anti-Anglo-Saxon overtone to it. This, we Continentals have to come together. We're both of us being screwed by the British and the Americans. Let's think in terms of a Franco-German Entente. And this in the middle of the peace conference, where the French are supposed to have been pursuing such a vindictive policy. All right. So what's the bottom line here when you do this whole analysis? Okay. A struggle between relatively moderate Americans, relatively vindictive, harsh French, with the British kind of in between. No, that view does not at all capture the dynamics of the Paris Peace Conference. A treaty settlement that emerged that was a gross violation of Wilsonian principles? No, very much in line with the Wilsonian principles as they actually existed at the time. The principle of a punitive peace, that Germany should be made to pay for her crimes, that Germany deserved to be kept out, not forever, but certainly for a prolonged period of time. Very much in line with it. But there was a problem here with a peace based on these notions of justice, these backward-looking notions to who had caused the war and how those people should be punished, rather than forward-looking notions of how do you go about creating a stable system. Because this sort of peace, the Germans would never accept it voluntarily. A peace that basically said, you're a criminal nation. And we're not talking about Hitler here, right? We're talking about a German policy in 1914 that, in moral terms, looking back, is no different, really, from the policy that any of those other countries would be pursuing. Right? The Germans are going to, they're bound to have a deep-seated grievance. You know, a very large, inherently powerful country is not going to accept this. And so if there's going to be German, there's going to be German resistance. So you've got to think in terms of how you would deal with that resistance. And yet the basic Wilsonian approach was to ignore the problem of enforcement. Here you're going to be provoking this German resistance, but you don't want to talk about the use of military power to make sure that the Germans comply with the treaty. Your basic philosophy is hostile to that. Because military force should only be held in reserve and used in cases where the issues are very, very clear in moral terms. And then it should be used without stint. Right? And you say to yourself, what could have been worse? You know, on the one hand, a peace settlement that doesn't look toward reconciliation and accommodation and putting the poisons of the war behind you and rebuilding bridges and so on. On the other hand, a peace settlement that's bound to provoke German resistance. On the other hand, a philosophy reflecting in part in the peace settlement that says you can't enforce this thing. You can't use force to keep the Germans down. Right? If you try and use force, we'll turn against you because we don't think that military power has a legitimate role to play in ordinary political life. You can use it only when your enemy has committed a crime. Right? What could be worse? You know, you would think that, you know, people would have seen this as the treaty was being negotiated. You know, but they can't see it because they look at these things through the lens of certain political philosophies. However, that problem soon began to take shape. Very soon, by the end of 1919, the Germans were starting to resist, and this raised all these issues of, well, what are you going to do about it? Right? And those issues then dominate the diplomacy of the immediate post-war period. Right? The period of the early 1920s. This is a very interesting period. You know, people think that. That these great international political problems, the possibility of a new war, these are not problems of the 20s. Democracies don't go to war against each other. You don't have problems when it's just democracies. It's only when the Nazis come to power in Germany they have real problems. You know, there are those notions. You study this period, you see these problems lay at a much more fundamental level. They're embedded in the basic structure of the particular system that existed at that time. So anyway, so let me end with that point this time. Next time we're going to look at 1919 to 1923, the struggle over Versailles.